So caring for ourselves, and specifically caring for ourselves through connection is what I want to talk about this morning. I want to start by looking at some specific examples from Scripture, or principles from Scripture, or from Bible stories, to get us started thinking about what we can learn from the Bible about stress. I'm not going to make a lot of points from these stories necessarily. I would say this is mostly to get you all started thinking about this from a biblical perspective, or to give you some prompts for stories or scriptures to dive into more on your own. Moses, I think, is a very interesting case study, if you will, on stress. He clearly had a very high stress calling in life. And at times he didn't handle it very well. He had times where he was angry, times where he had pretty poor impulse control, I would say. Eventually his father-in-law pointed out that this is too much for you. You need help. You need to delegate some of your responsibilities to other people. He clearly learned slowly, eventually, that he needed to rely more on God and more on others around him, rather than trying to do everything by himself. Elijah is also an interesting one, specifically the passage in 1 Kings 19. After the Mount Carmel experience, which you would think should have been the highlight of his life, or at least of his career as a prophet. But immediately afterwards, he is threatened by Jezebel and Ahab, and he has what I think can best be described as a complete mental and emotional breakdown. He runs for his life, whether that's out of fear or out of avoidance, I'm not quite sure, maybe both. He's clearly physically exhausted. He begs God to let him die. It sounds like suicidal ideation to me. He's filled with self-pity. He claims, falsely of course, that he's the only one left. They've killed everybody else who believes in you. I'm the only person left. Pretty clear loss of perspective. And he seems to be viewing all of his past work as worthless or a failure. And how does God deal with him? Well, I think it's interesting that initially God sends an angel to give him some warm food and something to drink. And then the angel lets him go back to sleep. And then the angel wakes him up and gives him more food and more cool drink. And then eventually he makes his way to the mountain where God speaks to him. And God asks him, "What are you doing here?" Now, I think it's interesting to look at the context of that. What do you think, or if you remember the scripture well enough, what did it sound like when God, what was the tone of God's voice when God said to Elijah, "What are you doing here?" Can someone tell me? Still small voice. In reading through that passage, I think it's easy to disconnect that still small voice with the actual question God's asking. And I'm sure I've read over that passage before, and I get to that point, and I'm imagining God kind of going up to Elijah and saying, "What do you think you're doing?" But that's not what it was. It says there was a fire, there was an earthquake, but God was not in that. And then there was a still small voice. And then it's the next verse, or maybe two verses later, is where God asks him, "What are you doing? What's going on, Elijah?" My own interpretation of it. It's an invitation to Elijah from God to talk about what he's experiencing. What are you feeling? What's happening? I think that's God practically connecting with Elijah. And I think we all know that sometimes talking about things makes a huge difference. It helps us to reflect on what's actually happening and what we're actually experiencing. But then God goes on to give him some practical reassurance. this is where God, immediately after this, is where God commands Elijah to anoint three other specific people. And it's an interesting grouping of people, but three other people that essentially are going to assist him in doing God's work. One of those three people is Elisha, who is Elijah's successor and eventually kind of takes over his work. And God also assures him that there's still at least 7,000 other people who have not bowed the knee to Baal. So what does it mean to live a sacrificial life? Something we often hear, that we're supposed to live lives of sacrifice, be willing to sacrifice for God, for our calling, that sort of thing. Romans 12:1 says, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers and sisters, on the basis of God's mercy, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable to God, which is your reasonable act of service. Now, what does it mean to be a living sacrifice? I think this implies that God does not necessarily want us to just be willing to die for him. That's usually what we connect sacrifice with, especially the ultimate sacrifice. The ultimate sacrifice is to be willing to die for a person or a belief or a country from a secular standpoint. But that's not necessarily what God is asking us to do. He might. In some situations, he might ask people to be willing to die for him, to die for his, for your beliefs. But God, I think, is primarily asking us to be a living sacrifice. If our act of living, if our lives themselves are a sacrifice to God, then I think it's pretty obvious that if we do that more and better and longer, it's a better sacrifice. So I don't necessarily think, and I can't say that I've heard this a lot myself, but I think some people sometimes, when it comes to mission work, or careers such as healthcare that are so obviously sacrificial, we think that we have the expectation or the calling, even as children of God, to be willing to completely burn out for God, as it will. I don't really think so. I think we're also clearly commanded in the Bible to be good stewards of everything we've been given, including our lives, including our physical bodies, including our mental and emotional health. So yes, we should be willing to sacrifice, obviously, but not to the point where we are damaging ourselves or damaging the sacrifice, because again, our lives are meant to be the sacrifice. Is your job stressful? I want a little bit of participation or response from you. Anybody in the group, or everybody all at once if you want to, I guess. On a scale of 1 to 10, how stressful is what you do? Or just raise your hands. About a 10?
4.5 out of 10,
okay. Anybody else?
Depends on the day.
Depends on the day, yes, absolutely. How many of you would you say that you do have a stressful job? Anybody willing to say that they do not have a stressful job? A few, okay, good. As long as you're not just being naive and delusional about the fact that your job is not stressful, or you think it's not, hopefully that's not the case. So what makes your job stressful, if it is stressful? Anybody? Shout out some answers. Dealing with family? Time constraints.
Competing values and priorities.
Okay, competing values and priorities. What else? Coworkers. Unstable patients, yeah.
I mean, they're all thinking and administrators.
Thank you. I mean, that could be lumped maybe sort of into coworkers as well, so. Anybody else? Any specific things that you would say make it stressful?
Your own limitations.
Okay, Your own limitations at times, yeah. True. Yeah, nurse patient ratios. Absolutely.
Limited resource and endless need.
Yes. Yeah. Now, maybe a better way to ask those questions would actually be, instead of just, is your job stressful, how stressed have you been over the last week or month? On average. Because I think most of us can say, yep, the job's stressful. At least some days, sometimes, in some situations. But a better thing to pay attention to, I think, a better thing to keep track of is, how stressed have I been recently? And then along with that, what has been the most stressful part of your job recently? Anybody have anything in particular? This can get a little more specific, because sometimes it is a specific shift or a specific patient or a specific call or a specific family member or maybe a specific meeting with the administrator, I don't know. But if we can identify what our stressors are, I honestly think that even if I can't control that stressor, if I identify it as the primary problem recently, it helps me manage it a little better, even if I can't control that directly. It helps me to be, it's almost always, I would argue, beneficial to be more aware of the details of what is stressing me out, what is causing stress, and how I can hopefully cope with that. So would you say you're good at managing stress or coping with stress? If you are, good. Again, I think it's helpful to be aware of that so that you can lean into that when you have a really bad day, but also that you can share your strategies with other people. If you feel like you're not good at coping with stress, the opposite obviously applies as well. It's good to be aware of that. Why are you not good at dealing with stress? What can you do differently? There's lots of practical things, I think, that we can do when it comes to dealing with stress. I do think it's important that we recognize and acknowledge that working in healthcare is stressful for a number of reasons. Now, obviously, that can vary a lot depending on what your specific job is. But we need to start out by acknowledging that, yes, this is at least potentially very stressful. Working in healthcare, specifically with direct patient care, is pretty consistently ranked among the most stressful careers. Now, of course, it's all over the place depending on what they use to measure it and whether it's just a survey or an actual study that they attempt to do. But in general, if direct patient care is included in the list, that's almost always towards the top, if not at the top of the list. In general, healthcare workers have higher rates of anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation, and substance abuse than the general population. Now, somebody passed a note to me yesterday and said that this came up for conversation, I believe, the first evening. And some of the either less experienced healthcare workers in the group or some of the students in the group were basically asking the question, so if I'm going to work in healthcare, am I signing up for a lifetime of stress and anxiety and sleep deprivation and Xanax and therapist visits? Is it inevitable? I have my opinions on that, but I'm curious what some of the rest of you think, maybe especially some of the more experienced in the group. Is it inevitable? What would you say to, or what did you say if you were in the conversation, to a nursing student who's in their last semester and they're wondering, how bad is it really going to be? Is it inevitable that eventually I'm going to need to see my therapist once a week and I'm going to need to take Xanax and I'm probably going to have trouble sleeping and I'm definitely going to have burnout syndrome? Is it inevitable? Anybody?
Nurses school taught us that questions that say always and never are usually false.
Okay, thank you, yes. Questions that say always and never are usually false. See, I would agree with that. Anybody? Okay, you don't have to work full time. might feel like you have to when you're trying to pay off your student loan initially. Yes, absolutely. If you couldn't hear what he said, if you're sitting in the back, there are other jobs that are less stressful. From his personal experience, he doesn't think he could handle still currently working full-time in the ER like he used to. Thank you. Yes. You absolutely will need a support group. Yes. But don't be a victim. Don't think that you are a victim. Good.
A decent therapist can prevent the Xanax.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. That's probably one of the biggest things that came to mind when I first thought about this question this way, is it depends on what exactly is going on. There have been times where everything's fine and this is quite literally the best job I've ever had. But there have also been times where, yeah, I probably should have been seeing a therapist and some Xanax would have been nice. But all the time, definitely not. Never, also definitely not. So it's somewhere in the middle. It requires a balance. What I would say is that if you are entering healthcare as a career, and you're just now suddenly realizing, oh, this is going to be stressful, either you started out really naive or very misinformed about this, because it is part of the job to a certain extent. You should expect a lot of stress. If you're not expecting it, you're going to be in for a very rude surprise at some point. However, I don't think that you should just resign yourself to, well, eventually I'm going to have pretty severe mental and emotional health problems. I don't think that's accurate. And I also don't think it's helpful to be cynical or pessimistic or fatalistic about it either. So what is stress? And is stress actually harmful? Stress is simply defined as the body's natural physiologic and psychological response to change or to a challenge or to a demand. So is stress good or bad? It depends. It's not actually all bad, especially when you look at it from more of a physiologic standpoint than a psychologic standpoint. We tend to separate those in our minds, at least, and I think there actually is a lot more overlap there than we realize. It almost always goes together. Physical stress can cause psychological problems or symptoms, and psychological stress can cause physical symptoms as well. The body is really reacting to it mostly the same way. If you compare physiologic stress and psychological stress to our last question, are you signing up for a lifetime of psychological problems? I think it helps here as well to compare physical and psychological. Should every one of us be on a prescription med and be seeing our therapist once a week? Not necessarily. If we did a quick survey and 90% of us were in that category, I would be shocked, and I would think, okay, we have a much bigger problem here than we realized. But at the same time, if we do a survey and we find out that nobody in this room is on any meds and nobody in this room is seeing a therapist at least once a week, I would also be shocked, and I would say there's probably some of us here that are not taking care of ourselves quite as well as we should, because I think that is going to be necessary sometimes. Now, comparing that to physical health, I think it's honestly similar to saying, should every one of us be on blood pressure meds in a GLP-1 agonist? I don't know, maybe some people would say we should, but not necessarily. However, should all of us be exercising and eating healthy and paying attention to our physical health? Yeah, obviously. We all know that from nursing school. It's very evident. At the same time, if I am in a higher risk category, if I'm at higher risk for heart disease, for diabetes, for whatever, then I should be more likely to be taking medications, and I should probably be seeing my provider more frequently. And I'd say the comparison is there as well. If I'm in a job that is more stressful, it's more likely I should have a lower threshold for considering medications, and I should probably be seeing my mental health physician, whatever they category they're actually in, a little more frequently. So is stress good or bad? It depends. Has anybody in the group seen the TED Talk, How to Make Stress Your Friend? Highly recommend it. I think it should be mandatory for all healthcare workers. It's not up there yet. My bad. There we go. How to Make Stress Your Friend. It's by Kelly McGonigal, and it's a short TED Talk on stress and on your perception of stress. Now, her primary point in the TED Talk is simply that stress is only harmful if you think it is. And she cites this study from 2013. There was a perception that stress affects health matter. This study tracked 30,000 adults for 8 years and asked them to quantify their stress, but also to ask them in survey questions how harmful they thought stress was. And there was a pretty strong correlation between both high stress and the belief that stress is harmful and negative health outcomes. Now, I don't quite agree 100% with her argument that stress is only harmful if you think it is. I think it's a little more nuanced than that. It's possible that, you know, she was just having a 10-minute talk to a bunch of people who aren't necessarily used to interpreting scientific literature, so she overstated her argument. It's possible she was just using hyperbole. I'm not sure if she actually believes it to this extent or not. But I think it's pretty clear that there is a correlation there. Of course, correlation does not necessarily equal causation. We all know that. If you look at the actual study that she cites, it's clear that high stress is harmful, and it's also clear that believing that stress is harmful makes it even worse. One critic of the study says that there are thousands of studies that show us that stress is harmful. It's damaging to the immune system, it's harmful to your mood, to your brain, to sleep patterns. But then the critic goes on to say, if some people feel and function better when we tell them that stress is actually good, I'm all for it. But stress is still a killer. So he does agree that, okay, there might be some benefit to changing your mindset on stress. Again, I personally feel that it's pretty nuanced. Another quote from Kelly McGonigal, though, is simply that when you do feel stress, you need to make sure you don't make matters worse by stressing about the fact that you're stressed. You need to reframe the stress. Learn to reframe the stress and make it work for you. Now, back to a comparison with physical health. What do we usually call physiologic stress? What is physiological stress? Okay, could be that. What is a form of physiological stress that is beneficial? Exercise, yes. What are you doing when you're exercising? You are stressing your physical body. Again, it's not exactly equal, but I think it's actually a valid comparison. Is physical exercise good for you? Is too much of it a bad thing? Yeah, obviously. If you just look specifically at your immune system, how does physical exercise benefit your immune function? Well, it dramatically improves it if it's a moderate amount of exercise, if you don't overdo it. It improves blood flow, it improves the flow of your lymph system, it does all kinds of good things. However, if you look at the extreme, I enjoy cycling, I enjoy at least somewhat following professional cyclists, especially in Europe when they do the 3-week long stage races. If you know anything about the Tour de France and what the athletes go through for that, it's pretty incredible. And a lot of people would argue that they are among the most physically fit athletes on earth. 3 weeks, every day for 3 weeks, you get on your bike and you ride 100 to 150 miles, and your average heart rate is 70 to 80% of your maximum heart rate for that entire time. And then you do it again the next day and the next day and the next day for 21 days with a couple breaks in between there, but effectively for three weeks back to back. Some of the top athletes in the 3 week long stage races are known for how fanatical they are about avoiding any sickness because they are pushing themselves so far that their immune systems aren't actually working very well anymore. But physical exercise improves your immune function, right? Well, not for them. It actually makes it a lot worse. To the extent that some of them will wear masks constantly, except for when they're riding their bikes, of course. That'd be a little more difficult. They'll avoid giving high fives to fans. And this is in the middle of summer. It's not in flu season. At best, all they'll do is maybe an elbow bump, if you're lucky. But they avoid contact with other people. Some of the top teams will go to the extent that when they are staying in the motel that the riders are all sleeping in for the night, they'll change out the entire room, new mattress, new bed linens, everything, to make sure that there's no possible contamination there, because their immune systems are so depleted. So too much stress can be harmful. And I really think there's a pretty good comparison there between psychological stress and physiologic stress. A little bit of psychological stress is okay and is actually probably beneficial. Too much obviously is a problem though. So some more practical things related to this. Some risk factors. Some things that you should pay attention to. Things that are more likely to be associated with you having an unhealthy stress response. Some of these might increase your risk of experiencing stress, but some are going to just simply make you not quite as good at handling it. Some personal aspects. If you have an inadequate social support system, if you've got any unhealthy coping strategies, sometimes the coping strategies we tend towards actually make things worse than the stress itself was. Poor work-life balance, sleep deprivation, poor nutrition, lack of exercise. So again, there's physical things that we can do that are going to help us cope better with stress, which means that if you're on the opposite end of that, you're not going to be able to deal with it as well. Two interesting things that I found specifically, or that are cited in literature even, that are related more to our personality. You can't really change much of this. If your personality, if your typical mindset is to be a perfectionist and self-critical, you are gonna have a harder time dealing with stress. It doesn't necessarily mean you should stop being a perfectionist or try to. You just need to be aware of the fact that it's gonna make it worse. And I think this is one of those paradoxes that shows up in healthcare quite a bit. Sometimes the characteristics that make me good at my job make it harder for me to cope with the stress of my job. Talking from the perspective of an ICU nurse, an ICU nurse educator, I really, really like if my new ICU nurses are perfectionists. I like if they're a little bit self-critical. I like if they're hard on themselves, because they are going to become a much better ICU nurse because of that. But at the same time, that's going to make it a lot more difficult to cope with the stress that goes with the job. Work environment. These might not be in your control, but again, I think it's helpful to pay attention to this. Some of them are very practical and very obvious. High workload is obviously going to lead to more difficulty coping with stress. One interesting one, though, is lack of autonomy. Now that makes sense that if I don't have a lot of autonomy at work, it's more stressful. But what's interesting with that is that it's not just the option to have autonomy at work that decreases stress, it's actually making use of that. There have been studies, for example, that look specifically at your autonomy from a scheduling standpoint. So those of you that can self-schedule should pay attention to that. If you schedule yourself to work four 12-hour shifts in a row, that is going to be less stressful than if somebody tells you you need to work four 12-hour shifts in a row. You're doing the same thing. The difference is you chose it versus you were told you had to do it, and it makes a difference. So pay attention to those sorts of little things as well. And then, of course, poor teamwork, poor communication is always going to be problematic, as well as exposure to end of life. And the big thing with this as well is that that is a stressor, even if you feel that the situation went well. Even if it was a good death, even if everybody was on the same page, it's still going to be a stressor. Again, you might not be able to do anything about it, but I think it's helpful to pay attention to it. Quickly, some of the negative effects of stress. Obviously, having high stress or having an unhealthy coping with stress is going to affect us and those around us. It affects our patience probably more than we realize. If you are not coping well with stress, you're going to have a much more difficult time taking good care of your patients. You're going to have decreased empathy. And there's actually a correlation with worsened outcomes. There are studies that look specifically at unit-wide patient outcomes and compare the average stress of the nurses that work on those units. Units that have staff that are more stressed, the patients do not do as well. It's a measurable impact. And then, of course, those around us, whether it's those around us at work or outside of work, it's going to have an impact on them. One of the things that can easily happen within a hospital or a unit or a specific group of staff is you start to have poor staff morale. You have issues with stress management, and that makes some people leave, and that leads to high staff turnover, which is itself a stressor. So more people get stressed out, so turnover gets even higher, so the stress level gets even higher, and then the turnover gets even higher, and it can cycle out of control pretty quickly. Some quick definitions for us here. Compassion fatigue. Somebody mentioned this yesterday. I think John mentioned this a little bit. Compassion fatigue is simply defined as physical or mental exhaustion and emotional withdrawal. It's frequently experienced by those who care for others for an extended period of time. It's pretty self-explanatory what it actually looks like or feels like. It's reduced ability to feel empathy. It's being callous. The next one I have is moral distress. Moral distress is defined as unease resulting from the inability to carry out what you believe to be ethically appropriate. So this is when you have a feeling, or know sometimes, what should be done. What is the right thing to do? And for whatever reason, you can't do it. It might be as simple as that's not what the patient wants. It might be the patient kind of wants that, but the family doesn't. It might be this is what really should happen, but we don't have the resources. We don't have the capability of providing this. Could be any reason, really. Then we have moral injury, which I would describe as a little more dramatic or a little more drastic than moral distress. This is when there's lasting psychological, social, or spiritual damage caused by us witnessing or failing to prevent or being a part of actions that violate deeply held beliefs. So you could kind of describe this as moral injury times 10, repeated moral injury, something like that. Burnout syndrome is simply a chronic stress condition characterized by emotional, physical, and mental exhaustion, depersonalization, and a reduced sense of personal accomplishment. Now, I think most of us have probably felt a bit burned out at times, and I want to make the distinction that that is different than burnout syndrome. Burnout syndrome is an actual condition that if you meet the criteria, you could be diagnosed with. Burnout syndrome is a big problem. Burnout syndrome is usually defined as having these three specific things. Emotional, physical, mental exhaustion is one component. Another component is depersonalization. And then the third component is reduced personal accomplishment. If you feel like you identify with one of those three, two of those three, okay, that's understandable. It's potentially a problem. But if you feel that you fit all three of those categories entirely, most of the time, then you might actually have burnout syndrome. And then, of course, post-traumatic stress disorder. Mental health condition triggered by experiencing or witnessing terrifying, life-threatening, or traumatic events. Some of the characteristics of this are things like intrusive memories, sleep problems, avoidance of any reminders of that specific event, or negative changes in your thinking or your mood, changes in your reactions to situations. Again, I think it's probably fairly common to have some of these. If you have all of these or most of these to the point that it is interfering with your normal life, then it is potentially a bigger problem. So, what can we do about it? What can we do to improve how we are coping with stress? I'm going to look quickly here, relatively quickly at least, at using connection as a means of mitigating stress. And I specifically want to look at the fact that, yes, like we talked about Friday night, we are created for connection. But I specifically want to look at our connection with God, our connection with community, our connection with our patients, and then our connection with ourselves, and what that has to do with mitigating stress. How can we use these different types of connection to deal with stress a little better? Connection with God, I think for most of us, is going to be pretty self-explanatory. As Christians, this should make sense to us. It should be things we already know. But I do want to make a couple points about it. I do think that connecting with God, specifically when it comes to stress management, should be more than just a vague, I'm relying on God to help me survive. I think it should be more than just a mystical or magical or miraculous or whatever word you want to use, intervention from God, so that somehow in ways that I don't understand, he's decreasing my stress or helping me to cope with stress. I'm not saying that doesn't happen. I'm not saying it can't happen. I think my connection with God should be more than just relying on that aspect of it. Most of us are parts of churches or communities that tend to emphasize practical, physical things about our relationship with God, about our worship even. And I think that these practical things, these spiritual disciplines, if you will, can have a measurable impact on our stress management. Excuse me. So, some practical aspects of connection with God. Praying. Some of these specific ideas on prayer come from another book that I would recommend, Praying Like Monks, Living Like Fools, by Tyler Stanton. He makes it clear that prayer is not just meant to be a boring, obligatory religious ritual. It's about a vital relationship that should transform us. A couple quotes from the book. Prayer is about presence before it is about anything else. Prayer does not begin with outcomes. Prayer is the free choice to be with the Father, to prefer his company. It is being present to the one who chose me first and chooses me again every day. Prayer is the act of seeing reality from God's point of view. And then the last quote I have from the book, be still and know that I am God. That means to slow down, to remember who God really is, to remember who you really are, and that is prayer. Another practical discipline that we can do is, of course, meditation. Again, pretty self-explanatory. Sometimes we need that quiet time. We need that alone time. We might sometimes think of it as being alone, meaning with nobody else or with ourselves. But I think it's also, for us, always time with God as well. And then worship. There's multiple aspects of how worship are connecting us to God. And I think it was Matthew said, made a comment or a statement about caring being a form of worship, which I think is very true. The biggest thing I would say is that worship shifts our perspective. It helps us to focus on bigger things, on more important things, which is always going to have practical benefits for me from a stress management standpoint. Here again, I think it's interesting how these types of disciplines are getting emphasis, are being more accepted as beneficial for our mental and emotional health, even outside of religious circles. There are lots of secular writers and thinkers and podcasters that talk a lot about the benefits of stillness and quiet and meditation and those sorts of things, which I think is fascinating. So if there are practical physical benefits from it for everybody, then I think it's pretty obvious that if you take that framework, if the framework itself is beneficial, then the framework with connection with God is going to be even more beneficial, I think. Connection with our patients. Now, this was talked about quite a bit previously. But one of the specific things I would like to discuss a little bit is empathy. Is empathy a benefit or a liability when it comes to my own personal stress? Now, obviously, we know we need to have empathy. But at the same time, that can increase the risk of burnout, like John mentioned. So is empathy a benefit or a liability? Like most things in life, I think it's probably a balance somewhere in the middle. But I think it is still pretty common, especially in healthcare, to hear that we need to protect ourselves by not becoming too attached to our patients. Or that you need to get used to bad things happening, implying that we should be a little bit calloused. That it might actually be best, big picture, if I'm a little callous. Again, there might be some truth to that, but I think it's a little more nuanced. True connection, I think, will make my work feel more meaningful. If I am connected with my patient, if I do have empathy for them, my job is no longer going to be just a series of high-stress tasks that I'm doing. I have a specific reason for doing it. And you could make the argument, actually, that the more connected you are to your patient, the more meaningful your job will be, which means you'll have higher job satisfaction. You'll have an improved self-esteem from a professional standpoint. I do definitely agree that empathy can make some specific situations more difficult. If I really connect with a patient or family to the point where I am emotional, in the moment even, that can make that shift more difficult. It might make the next few days, the next week more difficult. But at the same time, I would argue that it can make it better big picture in the long run. For myself, looking back at 15 years in the ICU, the stories, the patient encounters that are the most meaningful to me from the standpoint of I'm kind of proud of what I do are usually the ones that were most difficult in the moment. They're the ones where I did have a really good connection with the family. And after the family meeting where we discussed goals of care and end of life, the docs all left the room, the rest of the healthcare team left the room, and I stayed there to spend more time with the family. That was difficult, yes. It made my job more stressful in the moment, absolutely. But I would argue that to a certain extent that can make the job more meaningful in the long run. I also think that connection can frequently foster a positive feedback loop. If I am more connected, if I am more invested in, if I am more empathic towards my patient, they're more likely to do that tiny little thing that makes a big difference, which is say, thank you. You're the best nurse I had here in this unit. And that feels good. That helps me to cope with the stress of the job. Connection with your patient can actually reduce emotional exhaustion and depersonalization. Again, balance is important. Compassion fatigue is absolutely real, and we should be aware of it. But there's also something called compassion satisfaction, and that's something real as well. Compassion satisfaction is usually defined as the pleasure that is derived from helping others. And it's been shown to be a buffer against burnout. So you need to know where you are. You need to know what works for you to a certain extent. And I would argue that your personality has an impact on this. Some people might actually improve their stress management by leaning into it and being more empathic. Some might need to step back a little bit more because they are too invested. But I don't think that the answer is simply to turn off your feelings or your connection because you're afraid of getting burnout syndrome. So, connection with community. I don't have much on this, but I do have a couple practical things related to community connection as a means of stress mitigation. There are some obvious practical benefits to being connected with your community. If you are connected to your community, they can provide real-time support. Your community knows when you are stressed and knows when you might need help. That aspect of it became more obvious to me than I realized it was during the pandemic, when I was very disconnected from the community. Because every day I was going to work in the COVID ICU, and honestly, nobody at church knew what that was like. And honestly, most of them didn't even ask what it was like and didn't seem to think about it even. If you're not connected with your community, they have no way of knowing if you've had a really bad week last week, if you've had a really bad month or a really bad year even, and they can't offer that real-time support. So some practical tips on connection with community. We need to be intentional about this. And Matthew actually talked about this as well. If you want community, you need to be community. You need to intentionally connect with others before you need that connection. It doesn't work to wait until you're really stressed out and you need somebody to talk about and then try to bring up work after your Sunday morning church service. That's not going to work. You need to make that connection. And honestly, I've come to the point where I think it's beneficial to me and to my community if I'm somewhat intentional at looking for opportunities to talk about work outside of work, to a certain extent. Not all the stories, no. Not to the point where everything revolves around me and what I do. But if everybody else is talking about how their week was at their job, why am I not weighing in just because I do something that's so much different than everybody else? Connection works best if it goes in both directions, of course. And then lastly, connect with yourself. What does this mean? We could probably put things like meditation, quiet, time off, work-life balance in this category as well. But I mostly want to look at some practical things in this section. I think part of caring for yourselves well means knowing yourself, which I would describe as being a student of yourself. Figure out the details of how your brain works. Figure out the details of how your emotions and feelings work, especially how they are different from other people around you. What is it about your specific job or your specific role that is stressful? I think it's helpful to pay attention to that. Partly so that when you do have those days where you have to do those things that are more stressful, you can be more intentional about recovering from that, so to speak, and you're more likely to be able to be proactive. So, personal example, as a nursing professional development practitioner, there are some parts of the job that I absolutely love. I love teaching, if you can't tell. I'm an educator at heart. I love to get in front of a group of nurses and teach them something. I especially love teaching new ICU nurses. That's what I do. I love to have a group of them in our critical care fellowship program, where I get in front of them and I spend 4 hours with a group of 8 or 10 of them. And we have discussion, we have some lecture. That's what I enjoy doing. So that part of my job in nursing education is not at all stressful. In fact, that rejuvenates me more than anything else. But there are parts of my job that I absolutely despise. Most of them have to do with sitting in front of the computer and tracking education requirements or putting together an other education reminder, because joint commissioning is coming sometime soon. And I've educated all of the staff about this 100 times, but nursing leadership is concerned about the survey coming up, so they're asking me to educate everybody one more time. I'm like, I've already told them this. Nobody's going to read this email. But I need to write it anyway. So there are parts of the job that I like, parts of the job that I don't, parts of the job that are very stressful, parts of the job that are mundane, but there's also parts of the job that are extremely enjoyable. And I think it's helpful to identify that. I also think it's helpful to know yourself well enough that you know when you are too stressed. What are your warning signs that this is getting to be a little too much? I'm curious for some feedback from you all on this. What are your warning signs? This can be different for everybody, but I think it's helpful to identify this. So I think it might especially be helpful for some of the less experienced in the crowd to hear some examples from the rest of us. What do you see in yourself that is a warning sign that you are getting too stressed? Anybody? Get really grumpy. You forget to eat.
Arriving late for work.
Okay.
Not sleeping.
Pulling away from people. Yeah. Yeah, if you dread going to work. Now, if you're brand new, that might be every morning, but eventually you should get over that. Again, with this, it can be different for different people. And it helps to know for yourself, what are small signs, what are big signs, what are huge warning signs. For me, usually the smaller ones, the initial ones, are just lack of motivation. And maybe a little bit of irritability. Like if I'm just a little, like my stress level is climbing a little bit, I get home from work and I don't feel like doing anything. Absolutely zero motivation. The bigger signs for me have been sleep problems and just a general negativity. And the reason I point those out is because for me personally, those are huge changes from my baseline. I usually have absolutely no problem sleeping anywhere, anytime, any place. I'll get home from work and lay down on the couch, and the kids are yelling and screaming right next to me, and I take a 10-minute nap. I go to bed and I'm asleep in less than a minute. That's my normal. So any sleep problem is a huge red flag. I'm also generally very optimistic. So if I find myself starting to become a little negative, especially at work, about work-related things, that's a warning sign. Then I also think it's helpful to know what are some things that help you cope with stress, or what are some things that help you recover from stress. So here again, I want some feedback from you all. What are things that you do that you know will help you deal with stress? And again, this can be different for different people. Sometimes it's opposite for different people, in fact. So what are some of the things you do to cope with stress? Anybody?
Call a friend.
Call a friend?
Ride bike.
Ride bike. Fishing. Anything outdoors is usually beneficial.
Woodworking.
Singing.
I go to the shop and work with welders.
Go to the shop and work with welders. Okay. Yes. Yeah. It's good to have little strategies that you can do at work in the moment, and it's also good to have things that you can do outside of work. I think every one of you guys needs a hobby, for example. But it's also good to pay attention to those little things. Little things can make a big difference in how we cope with our stress, especially if you make that little thing a habit. Again, my biased perspective is from in hospital, so those are the examples that come to mind for me. One thing that I routinely recommend to new nurses in the hospital is I don't care if it is the culture on your unit and nobody else is taking an actual lunch break. If you can, you absolutely should. Get off the unit, walk down to the cafeteria, get away from everything for at least a little bit and take a lunch break. Some nurses seem to pride themselves on the fact that, oh, I don't need a lunch break. I'll just grab a granola bar and keep on working. Or I don't want to inconvenience my coworkers by asking them to watch my patients for 15 minutes. That happens sometimes, yes. And again, especially in the ICU, there are obviously going to be days where if you took a lunch break, you were the only one that did, and that's a little selfish of you. But in general, you should, in my opinion. Little things like that can make a big difference. So when should I be concerned? At what point is it a problem? Stress is part of the job. You should expect it. It's not always bad, but it can be. So at what point is it a potential problem? One of the things that I've found to be the most beneficial is this stress continuum model. As a quick explanation, the green zone over here is everything's good. You're calm, you're having fun. This is you in a healthy state. Everything's fine. However, any small stressor could push you into the yellow zone, where you're reacting to the stressor. Now, this is also not a huge problem. The yellow zone is relatively low risk. It's not a problem as long as you can get back to green quickly. It might be just one bad day that takes you from yellow to green. But then hopefully one day off, or a weekend off at least, will get you back into the green zone. The problem is when your stress level is high enough or your coping is poor enough that this is your baseline. Because if yellow is your baseline, one bad day pushes you into the orange zone. Orange is problematic. Most people are not going to get to that stage unless they have a really, really big, stressful, traumatic event, or they have persistent, chronic levels of high stress. This is where most people would put things like moral injury, burnout syndrome, compassion fatigue, that sort of thing. This is going to take longer to recover from. If you do find yourself in the orange zone, a day off, a weekend off, is probably not going to get you back to healthy. You need a vacation, at minimum. And then the red zone should always be considered a mental health emergency. This is things like PTSD, depression, severe problems. And again, you shouldn't get here with just one bad day. But if your baseline is here bordering on orange, one bad day could push you into the red zone. And here again, this is going to take a very long time to recover from. I would argue most people who get to this point are probably not going to truly recover unless they change their career, change their job, for at least a short period of time. Like, you need to find something less stressful to do, or take the whole summer off or something. It's going to take some time to recover from. So maybe instead of asking how stressful is your job, I should have just started with this and said, where are you on here? And More importantly, how long have you been there? And how quickly and what can you do to get back to a healthy point? If you tell me, yeah, it's yellow, but I worked 312s before we came up here this weekend, okay, I'm not concerned at all. If you tell me yellow and I feel like I've been there for a year, that's potentially a problem. Orange or red, that's definitely a problem. You need to be intentional about doing something about that. So, some closing thoughts. I really do think, I feel very strongly, that little things make a big difference. So I would challenge you to find one small thing that you can do that will either make your job or your life less stressful, or it will help you cope with it better. Something small that you can incorporate into your daily routine so that your lifestyle works better for you. A couple quotes and a couple Bible verses to finish up. When we are no longer able to change a situation, we are challenged to change ourselves. So kind of coming back to that idea that stress is only harmful if you think it is. Again, not entirely true, but there's some truth to that. Can somebody tell me who Viktor Frankl was? Psychiatrist in World War II who spent a significant amount of time in a concentration camp. Lived through pretty much the worst experience you could imagine. Man's Search for Meaning is one of his most well-known books. I don't know who this person is other than an author, Parker Palmer. He says, self-care is never a selfish act. It is simply good stewardship of the only gift I have, the gift I was put on earth to offer to others. Proverbs 4:23. Keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it spring the issues of life. The Hebrew word that's translated heart here is usually used to refer to your inner person, the metaphorical center of your emotions and will and feelings. 3 John 1, verse 2. I pray that you may prosper in all things and be in health just as your soul prospers. That's my prayer for each of us, that we could prosper in every way. No matter how stressful your job is, no matter what you are dealing with currently at work or outside of work, I really believe that, not entirely, again, I'm not going to argue that, but to a certain extent, I believe that we can change the way we look at things, and that will improve our ability to cope with stress. It won't fix everything. It won't turn your job from the most stressful thing you've ever done to the easiest thing you've ever done, but it will make a difference.